Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you to all the people who have come early, your stars. So my name is Ashfaq Alfan. I'm the director of the Sustainability Regulation Observatory here at LSE. It's part of the new Global School of Sustainability, and in particular its theme on mobilizing law, politics and governance. So the areas that we're focusing on are all areas that are being picked on today. What is the most constructive role for sustainability regulation? What are the deeper roots of the green backlash? And how can society and politics respond to it? What is the role of litigation as a tool of sustainability governance? And how can novel forms of international cooperation reinforce global sustainability governance? So it's interdisciplinary, looking across law, politics, and many other areas. So 2005 was a bleak year under any account. President Trump rolled back sustainability investments in the United States at the federal level and having a knock-on effect in many states. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was unable to agree. The negotiations, they were unable to agree on concrete measures to phase out fossil fuels. International aid was dramatically cut across many developed countries and dropped in absolute terms for the first time in a generation. The climate shortfall is very indicative. We need a 60% cut in emissions by 2035 to avoid the most dangerous forms of warming, and current policies take us only on 10%. But at the same time, amidst all this bleakness, there are bright sparks of progress, coalitions of the willing, the Santa Marta Conference on phase out on fossil fuel, where 57 countries representing a third of global economic output came together to discuss specific measures to phase out fossil fuels. That was in April. We're seeing impressive action at the national level in many countries with target laws locking in progress. And we have several successes at the multilateral level that our speakers are going to actually talk about. But I'd want to start first with a spot check, and that's a question for people in the audience, which is how many of you are more than 50% optimistic about humanity's ability to solve global environmental and economic progress, more than 50%. So people in the room, I'm going to ask you to put your hands up, and people online, we ask you to do a thumbs up or a thumbs down. If you're optimistic, more than 50%, please raise your hands in the room. But can you do it a bit higher so I can see I'm old, I can't. Okay. All right, maybe that's about... I don't know. Okay, how many of you are less than 50%? How many of you are pessimistic about this? There's no judgment. Okay, I think we seem to be evenly split. Are we able to tell on the online colleagues how where they're at? It's or the technology? Are they still they're taking it? I'll come back to you. It obviously there's a time lag. Okay, good. How many of you had concerns about the premises of the question or are undecided? Okay, I thought there'd be more. Thank you. Joanna, you put your hand up for that, did you? Okay, I'll quiz you about that later. All right, so this is an on-the-record discussion. It's being being recorded and live-streamed. Potentially, we'll have a podcast of it later. And the questions after the discussion, we're open to questions from the room and online. So please be ready to pose your questions at that point. So I posed some big questions, and today we'll be talking to experts who are actually making change on some of these areas through policy analysis, through research, through litigation and advocacy. We'll be talking about how they've done it and what the conditions are for success. So I think you've seen the bios of the speakers, but just the highlights. Tessa Khan is the executive director of Uplift, an expert and advocate who works to advance UK restrictions on oil and gas production. Shiva Thambisetti of LSE Law School has engaged in research and negotiation, so she's engaging in practice in that respect, on protection of the two-thirds of the ocean that are beyond national borders and on the Kali Fund, which is a new fund to share the benefits of nature's genetic data. Alex Cobham will appear online. He's in Spain at the moment. He's the executive director of the Tax Justice Network and is working on the UN Framework Convention on International Tax Cooperation, the first global tax convention negotiated at a universal basis at the UN. I'm saying that quite carefully to distinguish it from the OECD's efforts. And that's being drafted at the UN General Assembly, and that was a result of initiative of African countries. So we'll start with the first round of questions to the speakers, which is, where has the law worked, or where is it working, and what made it possible? So the first question is to you, Tessa. Your work goes after fossil fuel production and profits from it directly. The UK has made significant progress. It has the Energy Profits Levy, which taxes profits up to 78%. And there are extensive restrictions on most fossil fuel forms of production, some of which your organization played a key role in securing through litigation research. So how far do these go, and how were they achieved?
Yeah, thanks so much, Ashfaq, for a great set of questions and provocations. And just thank you to LSE for the invitation to join this really important discussion. So just by way of background, in case folks don't know, the UK is the second largest oil and gas producer in Europe. It's something that we don't talk about very much because the vast majority of that production happens in the North Sea, and it's sort of out of sight, out of mind for most people compared to, you know, a single coal mine opening, which attracts, you know, a lot of approbation across the climate movement. But the fact that we've been extracting a million barrels of oil and gas a day from the North Sea seems to have kind of flown under the radar, I would say, until relatively recently. And you know, I'm sure I don't need to tell you this, but we are now at a point in the climate crisis where the science is very clear that existing global reserves, either in production or in development of oil, gas and coal, if burned, would take us not just past the sort of 1.5 degree limit, but would take us very close to the 2 degree limit in terms of the exhaustion of our carbon budget. So it is absolutely imperative that a country like the UK, which has significant historic responsibility for the climate crisis, has the resources, the ingenuity, the expertise to transition away from it, does it very quickly, and also does it in a way that is fair for the people who work in that industry and the communities that have ties to it. And I actually think that part of the equation, and I'll say more about this later, but is just as important for those of us fighting for just climate outcomes, is making sure that we're not punishing people who, through no fault of their own, have found themselves in industries or communities with ties to high carbon sectors. So anyway, that was sort of the reason that we think it's important for the UK to transition away from oil and gas production. And in the last few years, the picture has changed quite dramatically in terms of what the oil and gas industry is able to do here. So until 2022, the UK actually offered some of the most generous tax rates of any country in the world for offshore oil and gas drilling. That's because it's an old oil and gas base, and it's actually quite expensive and complicated to drill in. So just to make it commercially viable, we had to offer tax rates that were among the lowest in the world. And that certainly incentivizes more production. We also have had a government, an oil and gas regulator, whose principal objective, which is enshrined in legislation, is to maximise economic recovery of offshore oil and gas. That was made into a law in 2016, which is the year after the Paris Agreement was passed. So query how you reconcile that with the climate targets that the UK government was embracing at the same time. But I think that tells you probably everything you need to know about the power of the fossil fuel lobby, which is another reason why I think it's important for us to try to constrain their power and their influence economically and politically. But we now are in a position where the UK government has introduced, was the first jurisdiction in the world actually to introduce a very robust windfall tax on the profits that the oil and gas industry made that were historic in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. The headline tax that the industry now pays on its profits is 78%, which is not bad. It's the same as a country like Norway. And the UK government, well, the Labour Party, in its manifesto when it was elected, also committed to ending new oil and gas exploration licensing as well. And I mean, there's a lot more to say about whether or not we will see that commitment through. There is a legislative vehicle, an energy independence bill, that's supposed to enshrine that commitment in law in the coming months. But there is an absolutely ferocious fight unfolding at the moment, because the oil and gas lobby, and, you know, in my view, this is what happens when you make progress, but there is backlash. You know, backlash is a sign. You know, if there's no backlash, it's because there's no risk. So take heart from the fact that the incumbents are fighting back because they're worried. That is what happens when you start winning. So we are in the middle of that here, and that means that there's a lot at stake and a lot that could be unwound. But the windfall tax in and of itself, since coming into force in 2022, again via a legislative mechanism, has taken billions of pounds off the value of the oil and gas industry here. It has absolutely, as the oil and gas industry will tell you all the time, deterred investment in new production here. It has constrained the economics and the profitability of their business model here. So, you know, it might not seem like the most obvious way to limit fossil fuel production, but the fiscal regime for oil and gas companies, given the subsidies that, you know, an industry that ultimately is high cost, high upfront investment, you know, they really rely on all manner of subsidies from governments. And so going after those can end up being a very effective way of constraining production.
Okay, that's great. And you've answered that backlash, one of the questions we have, actually. So, you know, there's that old adage, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then LSE starts doing research about you, and then you win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm still waiting for the research, then, I think.
We have research. I'll get there. Okay. Tons of research. Okay. That we'll rise to the challenge. And if, we'll talk about that. Although you wrote an article about fossil fuel abolition, I think, quite recently, so there is.
Oh, no, sorry, yes. I'm aware of the massive body of work that LSE generally produces on this topic. I just meant on this particular fight.
Got it. Yeah, well, yeah, we'll deliver. Can you just say quickly, so you're talking about some of the progress that happened.
Yeah.
What made that progress happen in the UK?
Yeah, so it was really a combination of tactics, and I think this is my main lesson, having worked as a lawyer and campaigner for many years now, is that you kind of need, when you're going after one of the most powerful, well-connected, politically well-connected, economically well-resourced, if you're trying to confront the power of an industry like that, an incumbent industry, you need every tool in your toolbox. And so just to take the windfall tax as an example, for us, the starting point for that campaign to tax oil and gas profits properly was a lawsuit that we supported, which was not one that necessarily had the best prospects in terms of success in court, and indeed it was unsuccessful in the English High Court, although it had prospects that were good enough to pursue it. But what it allowed the claimants in that case to do was to actually tell a story and put on the table the fact that the UK oil and gas industry benefits from massive subsidies and tax breaks, and to just start to make that a bit of a political conversation in a way that it hasn't been in the past. And on the back of that, you know, as a result of, you know, what was good timing in a way, I mean, it was obviously a horrendous humanitarian catastrophe, but that was shortly followed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and a whole new conversation around the enormous profits that the oil and gas industry is making, you know, war profiteering, as it was characterised by some in government at the time, and the fact that ordinary people across the country were seeing their household energy bills shoot through the roof, and the injustice, frankly, of an industry that through no additional effort of its own has increased its profits tenfold, while ordinary people are, you know, can't decide whether or not to feed their kids or to turn on their heating. And that laid the groundwork for a very powerful campaign that we coordinated together with folks who work on fuel poverty to basically say, you know, an energy system that is dependent on fossil fuels has left us exposed to the whims of autocrats and warmongers. We've seen it again this year in March in Iran. And it's left, you know, basically a small group of companies to profit exceptionally while ordinary people are left to carry the costs of that. And surely we should find a way to redistribute that unearned profit. Yeah. And so that was a narrative and a conversation and a campaign that was incredibly diverse in terms of the base of organisations and individuals and commentators who were supporting that overall narrative, to the point where by the end of 2022, The Sun, which is not a newspaper that I would name as an ally of this particular fight in normal circumstances, but they had a front page that had the oil and gas, the CEOs of BP and Shell on their front cover with wanted signs underneath them. You know, such was the level of animosity that people were starting to feel about oil and gas execs who were absolutely minting it when people were really suffering and as a result of an illegal war. So that was, I think, every bit as critical, as well as, you know, us and others briefing people within Parliament with ideas about what the design of this tax should look like, how to make sure that it's fair, that it captures the profits, you know, how do we ensure that that's then redistributed to support people with their energy bills. You know, so you have to have the policy detail figured out, as well as providing the political cover through a clear narrative and campaign that gives politicians the space that they need to then do the right thing.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll come back to you to analyse some of the backlash and how we can address it. Now, let's just move to a slightly different area, but only slightly, actually. So, Alex, could you tell us a bit about the UN Tax Convention and how that is trying to take some of the power for raising revenues away from richer countries to deal with tax in a more economically just and sustainable way?
Sure. And look, I should say, it's just on that framing, you know, this isn't really redistribution from the global north to the south. It's actually kind of win-win, at risk of using a terrible Blairism. You know, the reason for that is that the rich countries that dominate the setting of tax rules have done it so badly for so many decades that actually they are the biggest losers now. So, you know, we talk about in the annual State of Tax Justice report, we estimate that the revenue losses around the world from a combination of tax abuse by multinational companies and wealthy individuals hiding their assets offshore is roughly $500 billion. And as I say, it's the rich countries like the UK that are the biggest losers in absolute terms. But it's the countries across the global south who lose most intensely as a share of their current tax revenues. And so when you translate that into things like public health spending, it also has, of course, by far the most dramatic results on things like maternal mortality or years of schooling and so on. But so there really is scope for almost every country to come out better off from international tax cooperation. And I think that's why, you know, we're in this moment where geopolitically it feels like cooperation is you know, almost on its last legs. Actually, on the tax side, this push, and it's really unprecedented, what's happening in these negotiations, has started to gather momentum. Just to think about the history a little bit, you know, when the United Nations was created, it was given the tax rule-setting mandate that the League of Nations had. So the imperial powers of the League of Nations, who made some really bad decisions 100 years ago that we're still living with, particularly on the corporate tax side, they passed the mandate to the newly established United Nations. But within about a decade, as you had a set of newly independent states starting to exercise their rights within the United Nations, those same rich countries thought, yeah, enough of this, we're not letting them tax our multinationals. And so the OECD was created in 1960 specifically to set international tax rules in a club of rich countries and to take that power away from the United Nations. So effectively, countries have been fighting ever since to bring back the possibility of a globally inclusive forum for rule setting, and it's been resisted very heavily each step of the way. Look, in 2017, the Tax Justice Movement, which, you know, I'm talking about the Tax Justice Network, but also the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, which is the umbrella body for mass mobilisation organisations all around the world, agreed together a strategic goal of establishing a UN tax convention as the way that we'd establish the space for progress on this. With the leadership of the African group of countries, particularly, you know, based on work they've done around the dangers of illicit financial flows, particularly a high-level panel chaired by Thabo Mbeki, the African group actually has a coherence that you don't see in the other groups of countries in the United Nations, except perhaps the OECD members. And so the African group has been able to steer this process all the way through. And the thing that's tipped it, I think, in favour of cooperation, where previously OECD members have blocked anything like this together. But what they've seen in the last few years is that they too, even powerful OECD members, can have their tax sovereignty threatened by others, in this case particularly by the Trump administration. And so a set of countries that thought they were the rule setters, and even if they were setting bad rules, it was their power to do so, have found themselves really, you know, having to accept giving up tax-raising rights to the bullying of the United States. And suddenly, there's a little bit of solidarity that wasn't there before. And we're seeing in the negotiations, particularly the European Union, even to an extent the United Kingdom, being willing to engage on these questions. We're expecting, you know, within a year, that we'll have a final draft of the convention text going to the about to go to the General Assembly, and this, you know, really will create the framework body with a set of rulemaking governance that allows every country to benefit by tackling this enormous tax abuse that the rest of us all would suffer. As I say, it really has the potential to be win-win, and even the United States, which is the only country that's choosing not to participate in the negotiations, even the United States actually stands to gain very substantially. So you can see a path to progress, even given the resistance that is faced from that corner.
Great. Thanks, Alex. And you actually addressed my follow-up question of what are the conditions for success how you achieved that. So thank you for that. Let me pass to Shiva. So Shiva, you've been participating in the negotiations of the Oceans Treaty, officially called the Beyond National Jurisdiction, BBNJ, for Pacific and states and the group of 77 group of developed countries. So the treaty sets aside marine protected areas for the first time, and a method for sharing some of the benefits. And you're also involved in setting up the Kali Fund. I will not over-committing you, but you played a role, 10 years of your life, so that's good. So in terms of setting up the Kali Fund for paying nature for the genetic data. Could you tell us a bit about these achievements and how you got there? How they got there?
Yeah, so it's a lot to cover, but thank you for the question. But just before I start, I just want to say, as I was walking into the hall here, I ran into an A-level school student, and I look around the room and I see the school student, I see a diplomat, I see PhD students, I see lots of young people, and I feel very reassured. And I'm very grateful for the LSE for organizing such a fantastic opportunity to talk to sort of co-activists, if you like. So the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty is the latest UN treaty, which has now entered into force. So imagine this. We have two-thirds of the Earth that is ungoverned. There's no law for two-thirds of the Earth because those two-thirds are part of the oceans, part of the high seas. And these are beyond national sovereign territories. So who's going to make the rules for these areas, right? So at this point, in 2017, the UN General Assembly decided through a resolution to start negotiations over biodiversity in two-thirds of Earth's territory in this form. So it was a wildly optimistic agenda, right? They had four questions to deal with, which then eventually became four parts of the treaty. The final text of the treaty, after some extremely dramatic negotiations, which in the final run took about 36 hours straight, 36 hours that my back still remembers, we had the final text of a treaty. And what's surprising is that we very quickly achieved the 60 ratifications we needed for entry into force, which suggests that there's a sort of an enormous sense of goodwill towards this treaty, which is quite unusual, right? What does the treaty do? The Oceans Treaty does four different things. It sets out rules for capacity building and technology transfer, which is very difficult to agree in other parts. Think of what's happening at the WHO with the pandemic agreement. So the Oceans Treaty does not specify that technology transfer needs to be voluntary.
We have spent many years negotiating voluntary technology transfer at WHO. So that's already remarkable. It sets out the possibility for what are called area-based management tools, under which you could have marine protected areas. So there was a very, very, successful catchphrase of 30 by 30. So the idea that we would have 30% of the high seas as protected areas by 2030. That was part two. Part three is to do with environmental impact assessments. So you might wonder, did we not have environmental impact assessments on the high seas? No, we didn't. So this is the mechanism internationally that says if you're conducting high seas activities, you need to pass these environmental impact assessments. And there's also a new category called strategic environmental assessments, which has a few additional elements to it. And the fourth part, which was what I was very intensely involved with, is where the money was, which is part two of the treaty, which talks about benefit sharing from the use of genetic resources that are found on these high seas. So obviously this is part of the story, but I'll now move on to the Kali Fund. The Kali Fund is something that was that grows out of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which was finalized in the early 1990s. So one of the legally binding requirements of the convention is that when genetic resources are used, benefit sharing must flow back to the local communities and indigenous people and countries from which those genetic resources arrive. But what's happened since then? What's happened is we've moved from material physical resources to immaterial informational resources that does not really respect boundaries like sovereignty and geography. So the Oceans Treaty and Kali Fund share these very important characteristics. They both push the boundaries of sovereignty, and they're both about the circulation and use of information. And in both cases, you know, I think it was what was achieved was quite remarkable. There are reasons that, you know, we could look at for why that was successful. But it doesn't end here, right? So the BBNJ comes into force in has to be fully implemented by January of 2027. The Kali Fund has not seen the money that we thought we would see flow into it. So there's still a lot of work to do. So the law can help, and the law is a great mobilizing device. It brings interests together. It exposes interests that are not aligned. And all of this is useful if you want to run campaigns and be strategic about what you want to achieve. So I think the law can help, but there's a lot of work to do.
Great, thanks. Okay, now we'll go into second round, and maybe just in a minute or so, if you can just look forward. As you said, there's backlash and challenges, including non-implementation, but the possibility of non-implementation for each of these areas. What's the path to address that? So Tessa.
I mean, I think for our context, you know, we always sort of start with the decisions that we want made and the decision makers who need to make them, and to really try to understand what incentives they respond to. And in our case, I mean, it's a political strategy. We're trying to get the UK government to adopt a particular position. And, you know, we're in an era of, shall we say, unpredictable electoral politics. And so we need to be very clear on which constituencies matter to UK parliamentarians. And I think for this question of oil and gas phase out, both for moral reasons but also for these strategic reasons, we absolutely need to have an answer to the question of what happens to people who work in the oil and gas industry. And that's 10,000 people who are directly employed, about another 80,000 people who are indirectly employed. Most of them are geographically concentrated in parts of, in certain regions within the country, which means you have a massive political problem on your hands if those constituencies matter to you. If you want votes in the northeast of Scotland and you've suddenly got an oil and gas industry that claims you are shutting those jobs down, you know, we as a movement need to have proper answers to the question of what comes next for those people. So that's one thing. And then I think the other thing is we just assume, I would say, as climate advocates, that everybody, it's so obvious to everyone that you should be prioritising addressing climate change. And it's true that in a country like the UK, actually there is a very high level of support for action on climate change across the public, regardless of, you know, voting intention largely or where you live. But it's very low down on the list of things that are keeping people up at night at the moment. And that's because, as you all know, you know, we're in a cost of living crisis, there is a war on, there is a pervasive sense of insecurity. And so it's our job to constantly make people's concern about climate change visible to decision makers. You know, you can't take for granted that they understand that that's where the public is. And certainly there are parts of our media, I would say, who are absolutely intent on undermining that public consensus and public support. And so we need to, as I said, make visible that that support exists, that there are real political upsides to being ambitious on climate change, and also that we have an answer to the political problems that we're creating as well by phasing out fossil fuels rapidly.
In a sentence, what's the answer for the jobs issue? I mean, you've looked at this.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, it's 50% of what we do. I mean, the answer is to work with trade unions and people who work in the industry. They have the answers. They know exactly where they want to go. They know what training they need to get there. So all you need to do is pay attention to the people who are at the heart of the challenge.
Okay, great. Okay, Shiva.
So your question was, why was the Oceans Treaty successful, or how do we carry on the success through the implementation?
I suppose if you want to answer both, because I didn't give you a chance to answer before.
Okay. Okay, so maybe then I should tell you a little bit about why the Ocean Treaty was successful, or why it's generally seen as a multilateral win in a time that seems otherwise so dark. And then that question is also about, is it repeatable? Right? You want to know if it's successful because you want to know what are the conditions that we might repeat this on. And three things jump out at me. One is both the Carley Fund and the Oceans Treaty are very interdisciplinary issues. The science matters. For the Carley Fund, the accounting methodologies mattered, as it does for a lot of other climate change issues. The science was distributed between conservation issues and commercialization issues and industry involvement, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you answer a question that requires multiple people in the room? And this requires networks that take shape and take form outside the negotiating rooms. And what we see with the Oceans Treaty in, you know, I think when a treaty is being made, it's a very, very interesting time because you actually get to see what's in that black box, what then emerges in terms of the language. And there was a very close-knit group of experts. You know, you would see the same experts year on year turn up at the UN to negotiate these things. And there was a sense in which egregious positions were not taken because we kept each other in check. Because you would have to see them at lunch or a coffee. And if they're making an argument for something that is an outlier, then there was a sort of a peer review by lunch and coffee, if you like, outside of the negotiating rooms, which I think was very helpful. The second is there was an extraordinary movement from civil society organizations that came together. So a lot of ocean organizations were small scale, right? If you're a small Pacific Islands organization, you don't necessarily have the money to fund two of your experts to travel to the UN, to stay in New York for 2 weeks at a time to participate in the negotiations. So the High Seas Alliance was created with a lot of these organizations coming together and pooling their funds. It meant that they were then able to have a presence in this negotiating rooms. On the downside, it also meant that there was a conflation of issues. So there were large baskets of issues that were created, so all of conservation, and a smaller basket for benefit sharing, which was also a concern for developing countries. But I think that that strategy worked really well. And as you know, the High Seas Alliance won the Earthshot Prize last year, which is a sign of its incredible success, and it continues its activities for implementation. The third thing, which is really my area of expertise, is I think developing countries did remarkably well because they set the agenda. They don't usually set the agenda. And they set the agenda in one of the most contentious parts of the treaty by turning up at the negotiating table with a draft text. And this is very rare, because it means 134 countries agreeing on positions, which is not easy, agreeing enough. The person who wields the pen wields a lot of power. Who is going to draft these laws before you get to the negotiating table? So this was possible both for Carley Fund and the Oceans Treaty, and I think that was remarkably successful. So I also think these three things are possibly repeatable for other contexts.
Excellent research answer. Thank you, Shiva. And the point about developing countries was actually echoes what Alex said. Alex, one of the tax law professors was asking me which African countries are leading this effort, and I couldn't answer that question. And I think now I have a better insight into why. So could you address the question of what challenges you foresee? We probably will get a tax convention voted by majority, but how do you deal with the challenge of holdouts? And if the United States decides to be as bellicose as it has with other arrangements, what's the path forward on that?
Yeah, look, it's clear the United States is now taking this very seriously. You know, in the first session, so they were part of a very small group, including, you know, Argentina and Israel and a few others, who voted against at every stage of the process. But they did turn up for the first session, and they made a point of taking the microphone and announcing that that this entire process was illegitimate, and walking out and encouraging others to walk out with them. And it happened, just the way it was, that the next two speakers were Canada and the United Kingdom, who ordinarily might have expected to show some solidarity with the US, and both of them completely blanked it. And then the US delegate, sort of, with his head down, slightly embarrassedly shuffled off, and everyone maybe smirked and moved on. And that's kind of been the setting since. You know, it's better at the moment for them not to be in the room. But look, they are actively seeking to poison oil. You know, we are hearing increasingly that they are putting pressure on countries, OECD members in particular, not to engage in the online negotiating sessions that are happening in between the main public ones. And we're kind of, you know, concerned that some OECD members may be susceptible to that kind of pressure. So that's not going away. But at the same time, the momentum here is huge. You know, the G77 understand that where sometimes a vote that splits north-south at the UN results, even though they win a majority, it results in no effective action because OECD members can boycott and stop anything happening. But in this case, we know, and the G77 know very clearly, and the Africa group are absolutely clear on this, if there was to be a UN tax convention negotiated only by G77 countries, it would be an extremely good convention, and it would deliver an enormous amount that would have impact on, for example, the multinationals that are headquartered in the United States and the United Kingdom and so on. So even if those countries were to choose to be outside, it's not going to allow, in the way that the OECD has just given US multinationals effectively a pass from some of the main elements of the global minimum tax, that's not an option in the UN. So what is passed in the convention and subsequently by the Conference of Parties will be impactful as far as a US multinational operating in Ghana or Brazil or Indonesia. And that means that we're going to have engagement all the way through this. That's why the US resistance is there. But ultimately, you know, we talk about tax as our social superpower. It allows us, you and me, all of us, to choose to live together better, longer, happier, healthier lives. And that's why people care, even if we sometimes think it's this funny technical thing. You know, tax is ultimately political and social. And across the United States now, particularly in the last year, you're seeing this enormous movement in different states, including California, which is now the fourth biggest economy in the world, towards taxing extreme wealth and towards taxing multinational companies according to where they do business, which is exactly what's going to be embedded in the UN Convention. So it's throwing away this thing that the nations did 100 years ago that allows all sorts of transfer pricing abuses to get the profits somewhere other than where you're really doing your business, and actually just taxing where the activity takes place. The fact that that's happening across the United States, even under this administration, reflects the fact, as I said before, this is win-win. You know, it will be better for all of us when there is something better in place than the OECD. And ultimately, the resistance of this administration of the United States can produce a bump in the road, but it's not stopping the direction of travel. And I think with the African group and the G77 being clear about that, the momentum is really going to continue take us forward.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. And that's also being replicated in the climate area with really the majority of the U.S. people and economy under states that are committed to the Paris Agreement, and most of them are still keeping that momentum forward. And so, I mean, emissions in the United States are still going down, even under the Trump administration. Just to flag that Alex wrote an LSE blog with many of these arguments, so please look out for that. It goes into the arguments that he's made in more detail. It just came out as part of the LSE festival, so thank you for doing that. I'd like to now open to the audience online and in person for your questions to the panel. So I'll take three in person, and then we'll take three online, maybe combining questions where they repeat. So do you have any questions in the room? So with the spectacles, please.
Thank you. I'm also here, a former attorney at the Inter-American Court, and I have a quick question to Tessa.
Do you want to repeat your introduction? Was before you had the mic.
José Rodriguez, former attorney at the Inter-American Court. I have a question for Tessa, because you asked what's next. We see in the U.S., New York, Vermont, they're passing these Superfund laws, essentially giving away with causality analysis and taking money from carbon majors to fund adaptation measures. Do you think there's potential for something similar happening here in the U.K.? We have BP, we have Shell, or is it a litigation question with this new case against Shell here? And just on that side as well, do you see any potential or benefit in engaging with this narrative of energy and economic security, and how to best use that framing strategically to not boost domestic production, but rather accelerate the transition? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. The speakers have answered everything. Yes, the gentleman. Please introduce yourself the way Jose did.
Thank you very much. My name is Zafar Gondar. So I'm an legal expert and specialty legislative doctor and international law. I do appreciate the process for, of course, treaties and convention is very tedious, but it is necessary, of course. We have to take all the nations with us as well. So the one thing comes to my mind, because the states are still, the nation states, they're still stuck in sovereignty issues, territory issues, while the problem we are facing, those problems are not limited to the territory. Those are transnational and international problems, and those are common goods. So that's my question is there any work, or do you think that the nation states, political nation states, are at some point will understand that these are our international problems, regional problems. These are not national problems. Thank you.
Great. Okay. So any other questions? Let's see maybe if there's an online question that you want to. No? Okay. All right, well, let's turn to the panel. I think Tessa, there was a question specifically for you.
Thank you so much. They're both great questions. Just to start with your second question about, I think, the extent to which energy and kind of economic energy security and economic security focused discourse is helpful for us. I would say it is a massive advantage for people arguing for a transition away from fossil fuels at the moment. And I was actually in Parliament this morning giving evidence to a parliamentary select committee about the fact that in the wake of this most recent energy crisis, you know, the lesson that we should be drawing from it is that fossil fuels actually have been responsible for the shocks that have caused half of the UK's recessions since 1970. So this isn't just about what's happened this year or in 2022. This is a recurring theme, and that's because oil and gas cycles are boom and bust. They are vulnerable. You know, the resources are concentrated in a small group of countries. They are highly volatile in terms of the ability to control flows of them. And, you know, I think one of the great lines that I heard recently was from Bill McKibben, the climate activist, which is that, you know, sunlight has to travel 92 million miles to get to the Earth, and not a single one of them is through the Strait of Hormuz. You know, this is the thing about renewables is they don't have, yes, you have supply chains and countries that currently dominate those, but there aren't choke points the way that oil and gas trade has. And so if a country like the UK, and actually the vast majority of countries in the world, are dependent on importing fossil fuels, you know, they're not self-sufficient producers, the question is, how do you get more autonomy and independence over your energy supply? And as a country like Pakistan has learned recently, which has saved £17 billion on LNG imports compared to Bangladesh, for example, or its neighbouring countries, it's by installing 20 gigawatts of solar panels, you know, at a household level. Like, that is the key to energy security, A, and it's also the key to affordable energy. You know, in a country like the UK, it's not so much supply that's a problem. It's the fact that we can't afford the gas or the oil that we have. That's what's driving people to the brink of despair in terms of the 12 million people who live in fuel poverty, for example. So all of these imperatives, you know, again, this is why I think, as much as we always need to remind decision makers about the climate imperative for the fossil fuel transition, we're in a moment where all of the other arguments for getting away from fossil fuels, if you care about energy security, if you care about economic resilience, all of those are, I would say, even more powerful in the short term.
Okay, and prospects for Superfund,
that's a great question. I think because of the windfall tax being introduced, we're already pushing against the limits of what feels politically possible in terms of extracting more profit from the industry. And I think, as sceptical as I am about some of the arguments that the oil and gas industry has for resisting a windfall tax, it is true that if you tax an industry that's already being taxed at about 80%, beyond that, it does start to have a knock-on effect on, for example, employment decisions and shorter-term investment decisions that, if you're also interested in a just transition, start to unravel quite quickly. And I think for a just transition to happen, it has to be a managed one. And so there are trade-offs, I think, between, you know, what might seem like a politically convenient solution in the short term, which is a super fund, but, you know, what are the downstream effects of that, and does it mean that you end up with the political economy that you want? And I think that at this point we've kind of juiced profits and taxes from the industry probably as much as we'd like to in the short term, and now we need to have a plan for what comes next.
Right, because it's also been coupled with restrictions on
drilling. Exactly. Yeah, they're being squeezed from all sides already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe Shiva, did you want to?
Yeah, on the second question. You've hit the nail, on the head, sir, there with your question. And it is something that I would say, okay, so the question was, you know, most of our problems transcend sovereignty. But when we talk about public international treaties, the entities that author these public international treaties are states. That's based on sovereignty. So how do we sort of, you know, bridge that fundamental gap? And this is something I think in the biodiversity context, for instance, and the fluidity with which information, digital sequence information, can move through boundaries and take capital with it, is causing real problems. So let me do one of the problems. We can think about is in the pandemic context, for instance. In the pandemic agreement, there's a desire from developing countries to make benefit sharing, flow back to these countries on the basis of sovereignty or origin of these genetic resources. Now, think about what happened with the hantavirus, right? Some said it came from Argentina. Hantavirus is also found in other parts. So the virus itself is an element of biodiversity. It's a pathogen. If we look at sovereign-based mechanisms to share the benefits, such as vaccines or therapeutics, for a problem like hantavirus, it's going to fail, right? You're not going to be able to get the technology to where you need it, where the disease is found, because there is no correlation between where the pathogen is coming from and where the benefit needs to go. So I completely agree that one of the things we need to do is to really go back to some of these cherished legal categories. Sovereignty is one of them. But I would say that sovereignty is still relevant in many of these transnational planetary challenges, because every state has a sovereign interest in ensuring that other states follow the rules. And that is a pivot that has implications for how we draft these laws and how we look at compliance. And I would also say that another concept like sovereignty is legal certainty. A lot of times we hear industry say, we can't follow the rules because there's no legal certainty. And a lot of these laws that are now put into place have an element of vagueness to them, have an element of interpretative margins that cannot easily be bridged in terms of, you know, the industry's demand for certainty. So I think we have to revisit these notions, including legal certainty and sovereignty, and there may be other things that we have to come back to, and I think that is hard, old-fashioned work for legal academics.
Mm-hmm. Great. Alex, did you have anything you want to add? Or
just on sovereignty, because I think that's a really key point. And one of the successes of the framework and negotiations on around cooperation is exactly, you know, that we've managed to start pushing the boulder back up the hill on the definition of sovereignty. So in tax in particular, though in lots of other areas too, sovereignty has historically been used as a reason to defend bad behaviour. My tax sovereignty means that I should be allowed to operate as a tax haven and screw your revenues, right? And that's sovereignty. And actually what we've got now is, you know, when you look at the kind of threats of the Trump administration, you cannot tax digital sales, including on made by US multinationals, or we will put punitive tariffs on you, or we will tax your companies in the States. If that threat to sovereignty has driven at least some of the interest of OECD members in engaging in a conversation about cooperation, because it's forced them to understand what the countries of the South have always known, which is that your national tax sovereignty can only be protected by collective action. And I do think, you know, if there's a message from the tax space for the wider world, it's probably that one. And the quicker that we see that, the quicker we, particularly citizens in the North, can get our governments to act in accordance with that, the more space for progress we have, including with this administration in the White House.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have room for one question. Was there one online? Yeah, go ahead, Anna. Go ahead, Anna, if you could just say what it is. Okay. And then over there, I think you had your hand up. Yeah. Sorry. Or if you want to make it, if you can make it really quick, then we'll take it for both of you. Yeah.
Anna. Okay. This is from Anthony, an LSE external alum. How can the ICJ ruling on climate change responsibilities be leveraged to speed up the transition away from fossil fuel, while ICJ and ICC are being undermined by US, UK, Israel, Germany, etc.?
Okay. And we'll take those questions.
I think it was, Tiffany from LSE Grantham Research Institute. I think it's for Tessa, but could you say a bit more about the backlash and how to counter that, given the fact that media is heavily controlled and it seems hard to kind of get the narratives we were speaking about earlier to a wider audience?
Steve, LSE master's student, on just transition, and talking about the, talking to trade unions to hear their ideas, what are those ideas that you're hearing?
Okay. All right, thank you. Before we get responses, and maybe you could wrap your response with a lesson or a strategy that you would just want to underline, so that all that'll be basically the last time you speak this hour. I just had a few sort of PR things to mention. So this is part of the Global School's sustainable governance theme. There are some flyers. Like, if you want to be on the mailing list to hear about more of our activities, you can scan the QR code. So they're scattered around. And if you don't find it, is Beth? Beth, are you here? They're around on the table, or I'll show it to you. The other thing, we heard a lot about litigation. On the 25th of June in the evening, there's the launch of Global Trends in Climate Litigation. Joanna, what time is that? 6:30, right? 6:30. So please don't miss that if you are interested in climate litigation. Okay, so we'll go the other way. So we'll start with you, Alex, and then we'll do it in the room.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, Can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
I won't respond to those questions, yeah. But you know, I think if there's one thing, and I think this applies across all these areas, you know, the laws are ours. You know, many of them are very bad, particularly internationally, particularly in terms of their north-south dimensions, but they belong to us, and ultimately we are the people who collectively can choose what laws to make or to change. People in the north, in particular, still have disproportionate power. And it's our governments that stand in the way or get in solidarity with governments of the South and make things happen. So our ability and our responsibility to make our governments see that is, you know, a vital part of this process. And if we come together in the way that Shiva talks about with the High Seas Alliance, in the way that the Global Alliance for Tax Justice has brought people together into the negotiations, but also at national level to each and every government, that's how we get progress. And the more engagement that you individually watching this and listening to this are willing to put in. Governments, politicians don't see the light, they feel the heat, right? You won't beat them with a clever argument, but you will annoy them until they do something. And that's, you know, an important thing, perhaps the most important thing that we can do as a generation.
But clever arguments are important, right? I mean, you need that in order to... We'll have to shut up shop if they don't. Anyway, Tessa.
Thank you for the great questions. There's quite a lot in that. And also to wrap up as well with a comment. I think the overarching observation I have is just an encouragement to always think about durability of the change that you're trying to create. And this is where law is really important, because once something's legislated for, rather than just a political commitment or a promise or a policy, you know, it's harder to unroll. It's not impossible, but it does make it more difficult. So legislation has a role to play. But, you know, on the kind of flip side, thinking of both the ICJ advisory opinion, which was absolutely totemic, plus there was another very significant legal development that I haven't mentioned in the UK in relation to fossil fuel developments, which was the UK Supreme Court deciding that any environmental impact assessment for a new oil and gas project has to take into account the Scope 3 emissions from developing that project as part of that assessment. Now, that on the face of it might sound like a slam dunk, like you cannot, as I said, in the face of very clear science now, approve major new oil and gas projects if you're looking at the full impact of the climate harm that they create. But in a country like the UK, and I would say in most countries, courts will only go so far to constrain the decision-making of parliaments and parliamentary sovereignty. And so both the ICJ advisory opinion and the Finch Supreme Court decision will only get us so far in constraining the discretion of our decision-makers. And we, for example, do not know how the current Secretary of State, who I think wants to do the right thing but is under a lot of pressure not to do the right thing, will make a decision on, for example, the largest undeveloped oil field in the UK, Rosebank, even with an environmental impact assessment that takes into account Scope 3 emissions, because the legislation is designed for him to be able to balance that against energy security, economic considerations, national security, broader public interest, and that will always be the case. And so litigation on its own, legislation on its own, is not enough without a clear public mandate to do the thing that we want our governments to do. And so that's also the answer to the backlash question is, you know, in a hostile media environment, you have to show that the things that those media outlets are sensitive to, whether it's the cost of living or working class interests or jobs in particular communities, that we have answers to those questions as well, and that the solutions that we're proposing, and amazing that we are now in a position where the solution that we propose is actually the answer to all of those things, in my view. So that's great, but we've got to get much more strategic about knowing, you know, which message works with which audience. And, you know, to that end, I think just to end on the trade union question, that, you know, trade unions have defined a just transition to be just as much about process as about outcome. It's about who's at the table. And the truth is that most industrial transitions, certainly in this country, have been totally absent the voices of workers and the people who are affected the most by industrial change. And the history of coal mining closures in this country have left massive economic scars and a really damaging legacy for industrial transitions. And so the first thing we're trying to do is make sure that the design of what comes after the oil and gas industry in the North Sea is one that has trade unions and communities and oil and gas workers at the table alongside government and local authorities.
Thank you. Shiva,
please. Okay, so very quickly. I would like to make a case for being unrealistically optimistic. And I don't mean this simply as an attitudinal stance that you take for difficult problems. I mean this as a matter of strategy. Because what is optimism? What is an optimism bias? You overestimate the likelihood of success and you underestimate the chances of failure, right? Unless you have that optimism bias, you're not going to get started. If you get started and you face the inevitable failure because you've been unrealistically optimistic, that failure has a proportionate response, because that's where the creativity comes in. The creativity can only kick in when things are really bad and that failure kicks in, right? I think seasoned negotiators know this. If there's no tension in the room, no decisions are being made. The tension is what is generative and productive. This is not an excuse to not do the hard work, the rigorous work that needs to be done to draft the laws and to do the research in a place like LSE, for instance, the interdisciplinary research that we do need. But I would strongly say there is a theoretical and pragmatic case to be made for being unrealistically optimistic.
Thank you very much. How many of you are more than 50% optimistic about our ability to? Please raise your hand.
Changed any minds?
It's hard to tell if I've changed it, but I think it's a bit more. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for the audience. These are great questions. Really appreciate it. Sarah Finch, who Tessa mentioned, is actually speaking here 12:30 in the law school on Tuesday. And you can sign up to the mailing list to find out more about these events. Thank you so much. Thank you to the speakers. This is amazing. We'll send out more resources and a sum up of some of the arguments to follow. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.